Hello and welcome to the Double Pivot, the world's most agreeable soccer analytics podcast. I am Michael Cayley. It's international break. We asked you for questions about the USMNT. We're going to do a podcast about the USMNT. Thanks for listening. I'm joined by Mike Goodman. Ready to podcast?
Let's do it. The music here on the way in is the Whalers. Max is not with us on the other side of the virtual glass this week. He's apparently allergic to the U.S. men's national team talk, but we're going to do it. Please download, subscribe, make us happy as podcasters, patreon.com/doublepivot, where we will be taking questions on not the USMNT this week, plus some other not quite soccer stuff that we've got in store, I believe. Let's just go ahead and take some U.S. men's national team questions. Where should we start?
Yeah, so we got this from Nick Adams. Said, do you believe that Reyna, Dest, and or McKennie have taken the most exciting prospect title from Pulisic? Am I missing anyone?
Well, one, yes, you are missing somebody. If we're going to have this discussion, Tyler Adams has to be in that discussion. But two, also, no? They're all still kind of in a position where you're hoping that they do what Christian Pulisic has done, which is turn himself into an absolutely appropriate level player for a Chelsea team that is one of the best five teams in the world.
Yeah, exactly. There was a short period of time early this season when it looked like Reyna might already be doing that, and he's slowed down. He's still a good player on a good Bundesliga team, but he's not producing at star level.
He has both somewhat slowed down and lost minutes, and the team has as well somewhat slowed down. So now he's like much less clearly a standout on a team that is also slightly less good. And like to me, it seems pretty apparent that he's just run out of gas, and like he is a child in a COVID era season. Like this is entirely normal, but.
And Adams is the one other guy that you might be able to, like, he's playing midfield and wing back, and wing back is a kind of midfield, at 21 on a Bundesliga contending team with, like, four tackles interceptions per 90.
Yeah, and I think there's this perception, right, because he doesn't start every week, like, his minutes are rotational minutes. That this is a disappointment, but like he's sharing time with a lot of really good players, right? Specifically, basically Leimer ahead of him, who's just like does similar things to him as well and probably a little bit better, but is a little bit older. So like, you know, but I mean, I don't think there's anything out of Tyler Adams that makes you think, boy, we were wrong to be very, very, very excited about this kid.
Exactly. And I mean, I guess the Nick replied after the first game, like, oh, I guess I know, because Sergiño Dest was very good against the Jamaican second team.
And to be fair, has also been quite good for Barcelona, especially since Barcelona switched to a back three with then him getting to play on the wing where he can just bomb forward. And I think there is reason to believe that that sort of role translates to the U.S., even with just a back two, because you're really going to be putting out in Adams and McKennie and somebody, maybe Musa, maybe somebody else, once it's all sort of like put together, like a really strong international midfield. So
I think both these games were really pretty similar. I think that like the good player question kind of gets us into this because Northern Ireland is a better team than Jamaica without its best players.
Yes.
And so the Jamaica win was very easy and the Northern Ireland win was like pretty ugly for a while.
It was ugly in a way where like for a long stretch of time, they were like piling on possession, but not shots really, because they were really trying to break down a very compact and well-organized Northern Ireland side. And I'm not sure that was like the right decision process in those moments, but like I didn't find it the game plan concerning, I don't think.
Right. There's nothing wrong with trying to create good shots in a friendly when you're trying to learn how to be a good soccer team.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
Like, they didn't for quite a while. Until down the stretch when Northern Ireland were actually trying to attack them, and then they did. And So the thing I thought was funny about both of these games is that, like, the thing I thought going into these games was, okay, there's no Adams, there's no McKennie. These games are going to be defined by the lack of a midfield for the U.S. And that ended up being true, except for the fact that our good players are good enough against teams this bad that they can just, like, jury-rig a midfield out of, like, Dest and McKennie. I mean, out of Dest and Pulisic. Like, Dest tucking in and Pulisic dropping in. Like, that could be our ball progression.
So, basically what happened against Jamaica is that the U.S. struggled a little bit for the first 20 minutes. And Taylor Tolman said this on Twitter during the match. That basically after 20 minutes, Christian Pulisic told Sebastian Leggett to go away. That Leggett was dropping into space as a midfielder to help progress the ball. And he was basically him and Reyna were kind of playing in front of Musa in a three-man midfield. Like, that was sort of the structure within Reyna and Pulisic on the wings and Sargent Stryker. And, like, Pulisic just told Leggett to, like, go get up in the box. I'm going to occupy these spaces and I'm going to advance the ball. And then the flank of him and Dest did that the entire first half at that point, from that point on. And, it, you know, they're very good players and it worked.
Yeah, and Dest at Barcelona has really developed his ball progression game. I think we talked about this when we did our Dest profile on the Musa side, that, like, there was good stuff in his ball progression numbers, but it didn't stand. It stood out. It only stood out in the Eredivisie because he played for Ajax, and, like, the other Ajax fullback did more ball progression. So, like, if you're not better than Taliafico, are you, like? And now he is, you know, doing a ton of ball progression for Barcelona. And standing out on Barcelona, among Barcelona's fullbacks, for moving the ball into the penalty area.
Yeah, no, that's right. And, you know, there's been a real tactical shift at Barcelona. Koeman settled on moving into a back three to let Alba and Dest just sort of go nuts up the field, and it's worked quite well. Like, you know, Barcelona's playing, like, one of the best couple teams in the world. And Dest is, like, at home in that squad. He's sort of made the right wing back spot his after having sort of flitted back and forth between the left and the right earlier in the season as needed and all this stuff. And, like, there is, I guess maybe we should get into a little bit, like, whether Dest should play on the left or the right for the U.S. But he is a guy who is, like, unequivocally taking the kind of step that you really hope to see when, like, an 18-year-old goes to Barcelona.
Exactly. Like, he and Alba are both providing not just, like, the outlet for Messi or Pedri to pass to them, but also then moving the ball into the penalty area.
Yeah.
Once they get there. And Jordi Alba, I think, is a really, really underrated player for what he does creatively.
Yeah, I think everybody thinks of him as, like, the guy that gets in the box with Messi. That, like, but he does so much work in possession.
Yeah, and I mean we've sort of joked about how Jordi Alba was, like, you know, half of the attack for Barcelona for a while, and what Koeman has done is figure out a way to have the now 32-year-old Jordi Alba, who can't, like, literally play the entire wing, still be a core player for this team. But it's done it in part by giving some of Alba's responsibilities to Dest.
Yep. And it's really worked. So I guess out of everybody, if anybody were to eclipse Pulisic in, like, the hype category, it would be him. But he's a fullback. Is kind of the thing.
Yeah. I think the thing that is exciting is that last season we would have had, like, okay, we've got Adams. We apparently have Reyna, which is crazy. And we've got Pulisic. And this season, McKennie and Dest have both taken those steps forward as well. So, like, okay, none of them have performed at the level that Pulisic has over the last season and a half or so.
And Pulisic has obviously, like, struggled for minutes this year and is not where he was last season in terms of output.
Well, should we continue on to that? We've got to...
Yeah.
So, Baseline 93 asks, Christian Wingback is sick?
No. Look, I get why he will occasionally play there for Tuchel in the system that Tuchel has instituted at Chelsea, but no. Like, he's a guy who needs the ball at his feet attacking the box. That's just what he does.
And when he played wingback, he played near the box and attacked.
Yeah.
like the wingback position, I mean, the thing is that, like, in these modern systems, you can have a wingback who is just a winger. Like, Nkunku is a wingback for Leipzig sometimes. When Hudson-Odoi is occasionally played a slightly more defensive version of that wingback, but mostly he's just a winger when he's a wingback.
But what I would say is that Pulisic as a winger interprets the role as a wide forward.
That's true.
And when Hudson-Odoi plays as the winger wingback, he's playing as a winger.
Yeah, it's much more like the role as Nkunku plays.
Yes.
Than as, and obviously these are different managers, but they have a similarly broad conception of what a wingback is in this world.
Yeah. Yes, as do we all, I suppose.
Yeah, so, like, Pulisic, his production is a little bit down this season.
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing that is notable is his minutes are down more than his production in those minutes being down. They are, but, like, I don't think that, like, if he was playing every week, anybody would particularly notice or be concerned about it.
I think that's right. I mean, he's down about a shot per 90.
Yeah.
And that was in many ways the big step forward that he took last season. He's always been a guy who assisted a good number of shots, and those have basically stayed in place. The big jump in his expected goals last season has fallen off, and I don't know for sure.
Right.
And like, it's only 1290s, and he has occasionally played at least quote unquote wing back in those minutes. I'm not worried about it yet. Again, it's only 1290s, and when you add up when you just add together his Chelsea seasons, which is always the best thing to do, is to have more data than less, more minutes than fewer. Like, what you get is a solid plus attacking player, like, giving you 0.5 XG and XA per 90, not as a striker. Like, you love that. You're good. And with perfectly solid goals and assists to match. Like, I can see a way to get worried about this if, like, the production doesn't bounce back somewhat over the next year or so. Like, is this guy getting injured and not quite making the step forward that we want to see? On the other hand, like, you know, consolidation seasons at this age are just totally normal. So I am not worried. I can see things that one could get worried about if one really wanted to.
So, I mean, I think along those lines, we have a question from Matt M and a follow-up from James D. And Matt asks, am I crazy for wanting to see what this team looks like with Pulisic at striker? And James saying, I don't think that would suit him, but I'm also over here wishing for Reyna as a true false nine experiment.
I
think that both of these questions are sort of getting at the striker-shaped hole that the U.S. seems to be struggling with more than they are getting at Pulisic and Reyna.
Right. This is trying to solve problems with our good players.
Right.
And we got to see Josh Sargent play? We got a question from Jordan Vanderzweig, which is sort of in the same, you know, thoughts on Josh Sargent. Is there much reason to be encouraged just given the amount of playing time he's been given despite his mediocre top line numbers?
This is about Josh Sargent.
Yeah.
I go back and forth on this. He has gotten a lot of playing time and his numbers are exceedingly mediocre and he is young.
Yeah.
He has struck me watching him as a guy who works very hard but is not constantly in good positions. Like, you don't watch his game and think, oh, the goals are coming.
That's the thing. Like, it's... he's just not getting shots. And the problem here, I think, in some ways, is that shot volume tends to be a young player skill.
Yeah.
Like, it tends to be that you've got that skill, and this is when you are, you know, both the most aggressive in taking shots and just the quickest to those spaces.
Now, look.
And he just doesn't seem to be getting
it. Now, look. Tends to be does a lot of work there, right? And, like,
mm-hmm.
we can come up with plenty of examples over the last few years of players that didn't have tons of shots when they were young but were getting playing time and then developed those shots. You know, Marcus Rashford to a certain degree. Dominic Calvert-Lewin, for sure. You know, guys like that who just, like, the shots came along with the rest of their game. And maybe that's Josh Sargent. But he hasn't shown it yet. But
exactly.
The issue here is that then you look at the rest of the striking core, especially with Jordan Morrison injured. And it's just like, well, who else is there?
Exactly. Like, it is. What do you do with this? And this is why, like, people are suggesting, do you move?
Right.
Do you play a false nine kind of player?
I mean, I think we should circle back to that, but before we do, we should at least touch on Daryl DK. Who James Scahan asks, what is DK's ceiling as a striker in Europe's top five leagues? Because he has come out of nowhere and all of a sudden is a mainstay on a Barnsley team storming up the championship.
Yeah.
Scoring goals like it's going out of style.
Like, well done, kid.
And, like, he came in for Siobhan against Northern Ireland and, like, looked good.
Oh, yeah.
Like, quite good. There is, however, one significant drawback. His numbers at Barnsley are absolutely terrible. Just, like, terrible. Like,
yeah, like...
I was talking about this on Twitter with our friend Kim, right? And she's just like,
mm-hmm.
he just goes whole games without taking shots. What's happening? And, you know, strikers go through this where they score a lot of goals, but, like, this specific thing where you score a lot of goals from a low XG without a lot of shots, it doesn't continue.
Exactly. Like it's already... Now, the thing that I would say is that what was honestly most... The one thing that you could say... The one positive thing I would say is that going from taking 2.3 shots per 90 in MLS to taking 2 shots per 90 in the championship.
Yeah.
That's a good sign. Like, and that is also a sign that, like, it wasn't completely insane that he went to MLS from the championship.
The championship despite, from MLS, yeah.
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 Which, you know, is a big jump, and he was not obviously, and again, he was averaging a little over 2 shots per 90 for Orlando City. Like, so I am a little bit higher on DK, I think, because I've, like, missed the discourse.
Yes.
And I look at this and I see somebody who is 20 years old and has, like, managed to move to the championship straight from MLS and look okay.
So here's a question.
Like,
then, the BBC reported that a Big Six club put in a $10 million bid for DK, which Orlando City rejected. Who do you think put in the bid? Which I think we can both say, who the hell knows.
Yeah.
And of any Premier League team, who should put in the bid for him?
I mean, certainly none of the Big Six.
No. I mean, if I said to you right now that, like, Christian Benteke is old, he's got a lot of money on him, and Crystal Palace can fob him off on somebody, and they're going to bid $10 million for Daryl DK. Is he good enough for Crystal Palace?
Like, probably not.
Yeah.
I think the problem with this sort of thing is that the reason, like, if this is true, which it strikes me as, there's ways this could be true that would be less ridiculous.
You mean if they were planning to do that and then loan him out forever, but we own an American?
And the thing is that, like, that's the problem with, like, a Crystal Palace buying someone like
that, he'd have to play,
is the opportunity cost.
Yeah.
Like, if you're Crystal Palace and you buy one striker from Orlando City or from Barnsley or whatever, you know, they've got to play. You've got to commit to them. and you should probably be getting someone who has clearer, like, right now upside than DK. Like, if somebody wanted to come in for a and buy him for a small amount of money and stash him on, in a loan army, like, it's not completely crazy.
The Miasco plan.
Yeah.
All right. Should we hop over?
Anyway, I just want to say that, like, Daryl DK is like, wow, this guy's gonna get bid on by a Big Six Premier League club. Like, that's ridiculous. But Daryl DK as a player who is getting some shots in the championship, after having very little in his MLS profile that suggested that was who he was at age 20, that's kind of fun.
Yeah, you've definitely missed the Daryl DK discourse.
I know, and I have the correct perspective on this.
It is true. Like, I mean, I think I've talked about this on the podcast before, where, like, sometimes I'll just be like, I'll have, like, the reversion to the underlying stats baked into my, like, opinion of a player, and then I'll get very confused when, like, everybody seems to be souring on this player who was just doing, like, exactly what I expect them to do, and it's just like, oh, right, you guys didn't have all this baked in your brain already.
I'm like, hey, this guy's doing okay in the championship at 20.
All right, so let's go back to the original question here, which is, like, should they just try to not play with a striker? And, like, you also have, like, Sebastian Leggett and Brandon Aaronson sort of, like, circling around these creative attacking positions. And, like, that's a lot of, like, if you can do it without a problem, getting Brandon Aaronson on the field instead of Sargent is, like, a talent upgrade, right? Like, it is. So should they?
Yeah, I think that there's a, like, I think that the problem here is, like, what are you aiming toward?
Right.
And, you know, if there was a important competition that I wanted to see the U.S. wanted to win,
I mean,
right now,
I think they should kind of treat the Gold Cup that way this summer. Like, you don't have very many competitions before a World Cup that you can, like, plausibly say, we want to seriously commit to win this tournament. And, like, it is good for a team to do that. And, like, to me, like, the best developmental thing you can do for this team is, like, just, like, try to win the Gold Cup right now.
Yeah. And Aaronson is, like, on his way to being in that conversation about exciting players.
Oh, absolutely.
Because he not
probably
only went to Salzburg.
It was probably unfair of us that we didn't include him when we were talking about everybody.
Yeah, like, I think the fundamental problem is that neither of us has Austrian stats.
Yeah, that's probably true. And they are already out of Europa League, so I don't even have their Europa League, like his Europa League stats to like look at.
Exactly. But like, he's gone to Salzburg and he's just played.
Yep.
And he's got 2-2 in a little over 600 minutes.
Can't complain about that.
And like, these are the kinds of numbers that it's early, and Salzburg stats can get really weird because they are much, much better than the other teams in the Austrian Bundesliga.
Yes.
But at the same time, that also means that coming in and immediately playing for Salzburg as the best team in the Austrian Bundesliga, those minutes should be taken as significantly more meaningful than you'd think coming into an Austrian team. And so, like, and I thought that, like, again, this is against bad competition, but it was pretty clear that he was offering quite a bit creatively, and, like, creatively around the penalty area and in the penalty area in a way that was quite different. And, like, if he's that player and suddenly you've got Reyna and Pulisic and Aronson, I think you need to if you think he is that player, I think you need to start thinking about how to have those guys be a front three.
Just start playing. But I mean, you could just play the three of those guys behind a striker with McKennie and Adams behind them. Like, that's like Reyna's a 10. Like, you could just play Pulisic and Aronson on either side of Reyna with a striker in front of them. Like, that's a totally legit lineup with a striker. Now, I'm not sure it's like the best choice, and I'm sure we're gonna get like Jesse Zardes in the mix as well when we see like the full team as we start to get towards the summer, when we don't have like the great divide between the Euro players and the MLS players, or at least the handful of MLS players that are gonna join up with this club. I'm usually a big believer if you've got talented like players, just kind of like put them in their best positions. Don't try to get fancy. Don't mess around. It's international soccer. Don't outthink yourself. So, like, to me, that would just be like put the three of them behind a striker. But I could see where one might make the argument here.
Yeah. And I mean, this kind of moves us into and this is, again, a question I think we're going to, you know, I have questions about the question.
Us never.
But Nathaniel Locke asked, if you were the manager of the USMNT, what's your ideal formation? And so weigh the factors of development, win now, etc., however you'd like.
I mean, for me, it's either a 4-2-3-1 or a 4-3-3. And you want Pulisic, Reyna, you like the guys we've been talking about, right? McKennie and Adams, Pulisic and Reyna, Dest, and to a certain extent Aronson, you just want them on the field. And like, they can, like, the you maybe lean towards 4-2-3-1 so that you can play Aronson, Pulisic, and Reyna together, but like, there's enough minutes even if you go 4-3-3 that you don't. Although then you start talking about, okay, so who's the third midfielder? And like, that's an interesting question. Kellen Acosta got a bunch of minutes. I like Kellen Acosta. I don't think that like he's a guy that you pick a formation in order to get on the field. He would have been the best central midfielder on the 2010 era U.S. men's national team, and he is like an afterthought depth piece on the current U.S. men's national team. And that's sort of like where the development of this group is. The other player who I'm sort of like not mentioning is a must be on the field, even for development's sake, is Yunus Musa, who, like, I guess we could talk about a little bit. He played at the base of the midfield, basically, this break. And, like, I guess the teams they were playing weren't very good. So, like, it was fine.
Yeah, I mean, he continues to, like, he's one, I want to be clear about what this means when I say it, but he's one of the worst players in La Liga.
Yep.
And now the thing about that is that there's a lot of people, a lot of professional soccer players who would be worse in La Liga than Yunus Musa. The fact that he is playing in La Liga gives you a like high level to be working off of there, but he doesn't do anything. He runs around and pressures the ball some. He's a winger, but he doesn't do anything in the penalty area. And
the thing is that, like, I think everybody thinks he's a midfielder who's being forced to play on the wing.
Right. But he's also, like, not... He also doesn't hold possession and pass the ball.
Right. It's not like he's a midfielder who's being deployed on the wing and is therefore doing decent midfield stuff on the wing. He's a midfielder being deployed on the wing trying to do winger stuff and failing.
Yeah. And so, you know, he's recently turned 18 and, you know, he's playing all these minutes, so that's great. But, like, everything that I've seen and then watching him for the Usment sort of confirms this. If he were a guy who had, like, gotten a cup of coffee with a Valencia and was mostly on their youth team or whatever, like, I'd be like, oh, that's pretty good.
Right.
But if you're coming into this, like, okay, this guy is a, like, solid La Liga player, he should have done a lot more against two very bad teams.
And I mean, I think that one thing to keep in mind here about him specifically is that we're 18 months from a World Cup. And from what we've seen of him now, even if his best case scenario is a very good player, like, even if you look at him and you're like, well, imagine what, say, Weston McKennie would have been like playing before his 18th birthday for a Bundesliga side, right? He's not going to make the jump to Weston McKennie at Schalke until after the next World Cup.
Right. We could get lucky.
Yeah, we could.
You know.
Yeah, sure.
But like, I think part of this is, like, when I think about how you want to set up a national team side, like, the first thing you think about is, okay, what is a normal, uncomplicated way to line up these players,
right,
such that our 3, 4, 5 best players are in the right places, and such that we don't have any rules we have to give to terrible players.
Yep. Which, by the way, is also why Dest is so valuable, because he is equally comfortable on the left or the right, and then you've got, like, a number of fullback options on either side that you can sort of, like, lean into. And, like, it's not clear to me that, like, Anthony Robinson at left back and Dest on the right is a better set of talent than Dest on the left with either Reggie Cannon or Brian Reynolds if he develops this season on the right. That's just one of those things where you're like, well, whichever of that set of non-Dest fullbacks develops is the guy.
Yeah, and then Dest allows you to do that. I think that, like, when you start and so what that means then is that you based on this Musa conversation, we're saying, okay, you got to get McKennie and Adams in there in the right positions.
Yep.
You want the right places to put Pulisic and Reyna. Increasingly, you want the right place to put Aronson. And it starts to look like a 4-2-3-1.
Yep.
It also starts to look like a very attacking 4-2-3-1.
Which is, like, fine for CONCACAF.
Yep.
It is an interesting problem. I've never, like, in our lifetimes, none of you have we had this problem with the U.S. men's national team where you look at their talent and you're like, well, the way to set up is just to, like, take it to people and hope for the best. Whereas, like, for the entirety of their existence, the problem has been, well, we have better baseline talent than the rest of CONCACAF, but we have absolutely no ability or capacity to set up in an attacking manner to take advantage of that fact most of the time. And then, like, sometimes...
And in part, that's because the gap was not that large at the talent level.
Right.
It existed.
But at some point, then, also, that led to, like, some cool upsets, like, when the U.S. was at their best. Like, you could, like, be compact and then, like, get two great counterattacking goals against Spain in a Confederations Cup. You could, like, press Ghana, like, to get to the quarterfinals of a World Cup. Like you could do that stuff because you were just sitting compact. And then, of course, you had the Klinsmann years where he's like, well, we're not going to do that anymore. But he had no capacity or, like, ideas for, like, what the not that should be. And then all of a sudden now you have both talent on the field and a you know, a manager in Greg Berhalter who seems to have like cohesive plans for what to do with that talent.
Yeah. And one thing that he did at the end of the Northern Ireland game was try out a 3-4-3.
Yeah.
Which is one of those classic, like, we don't have two good center backs, so how about if we play three center backs?
Right.
But and also, is also like not a crazy way to use a team that has very attacking fullbacks, and one of their central midfielders is Weston McKennie, who is like not really a central midfielder.
Yep.
Like if you can find a way to make it work with three center backs, like you're not really losing one of your good attacking players.
If you're doing that, then you get into the discussion at the other end of the field because you lose an attacking player about, okay, are we considering not playing with a striker? Or does it just mean that Aronson loses out? Because he would be the guy.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know. Like, if you can find a center back to play next to Brooks, or if you can make yourself comfortable with Aaron Long, like, I think that that's what you do. But I don't know if that happens. Somebody asked about the center backs, right?
Yeah, and I mean, Chris Richards is moved into the Hoffenheim side.
Yeah, and has not really gotten a crack in four appearances this year. And I'm a little confused by that.
Yeah, me too. He is so far. Hoffenheim play a little weird, but he is an incredibly active central defender.
Yeah. That was Jason Stahl who asked, "Does anyone want to win the starting central defense spots?" And like, he's not wrong, yeah. But like, Brooks is going to be one of the two. Like, he just, assuming he's healthy, I don't really see anybody dislodging Brooks.
Right,
but like. Yeah, I don't understand why Chris Richards isn't more in the mix. Especially
Aronson being a sub from his impressive like breaking into RB Salzburg, like that makes sense because of the talent that is in front of him.
Yeah,
Richards doing the same thing at Hoffenheim, like it
and like
that be a paper thin door.
Yeah, and like. In November, during the international break, he got the call but was, like, still at Bayern and barely playing. Okay, fair enough. I really would have expected him to start at least one match, and I was surprised he did not.
Yeah, so, I mean, the big thing here is that, like, we're taught how to put together, like, a team with really talented players on it. And this is Thomas Weber asks, I think this is... like the right question to be asking about the U.S. right now. Are we seeing a golden generation of American soccer players or have European teams figured out that American players are relatively cheaper than a French, German, English equivalent? U.S. population supporting infrastructure means there were good players here to be developed all along. And I would somewhat dispute the premise of this question.
Yeah.
I think that there is a third option here, which I think is the correct option, which is that the U.S. is now developing talent in an infrastructure that didn't used to produce good players, but now does.
I think it's both. I think that everybody's kind of a copycat, right? And it has gotten easier for talented American kids to get into European development pipelines. And so that means that the top percentile of those talents are going to more reliably develop. Although it's like they're coming through MLS too. So I'm like, but this has also been going on in MLS where there has been an expanded and developed academy system through MLS to find and develop more talent. So there is a wider net that is like sucking in talent is part of it. But it is also the case that European clubs in particular are less skeptical of American talent now than they have ever been. And that's for any number of reasons, including like you have Pulisic who's proof positive. You have Gio Reyna, who, like, he has an advantage because his name is Reyna. So, like, it was easier for them to believe, but then he, like, demonstrates, right? You have, like, you know, this is not necessarily, like, dual nationals born and raised in Germany getting developed here, right? Like, you just have a lot of teenagers who are, like, successfully, like, transitioning to Europe. Like, McKinney and Adams are those guys as well. And, like, you know, when that happens, like, if you can convince the on-field people that, like, this isn't a marketing ploy, then the off-field people are thrilled because of the marketing purposes, right? So, like, once you cross that threshold, it really does become easier for this pipeline to develop.
Yeah, it's reinforcing. But, like, I do not think that, like, 8 years ago, like, with a different set of beliefs among European sporting directors would have led to, like, 18-year-olds popping out of MLS and, like, being good on Europa League teams.
No, I don't think that that's right. But, like, you could imagine a world where Clint Dempsey at Fulham led to a generation, this happening a generation ago. Like, it wasn't like European talent scouts, like, looked at Dempsey and were like, we all need to find the next Dempsey. They looked at Dempsey and were like, eh. And then you need both, right? You need the pool of talent to develop behind the pioneers, and you need the talent evaluators to be looking, to believe in it. And you had neither then, and you have both now.
Right. I just think that the talent pool is the more determining factor.
Yeah, but it's a question of, like, how do you grow a talent pool? Like, that's not an easy... Like, it is also true that if you can't look at, like, talented young athletes and show them a path to success in football, in soccer, those talented young athletes will not play soccer. You know, I don't want to get into, like, what if our best athletes played soccer, because that's not the argument. The argument is, what if the athletes who were just not quite physically appropriate for basketball or baseball or football, but were for soccer, played soccer, right? Like that is always the argument. It's like the 5'8 D2 college point guard that, like, never has a realistic chance of success in the NBA, but is an off-the-charts athlete, and, like, if he'd been playing soccer since he was 6, could absolutely make it as a soccer player. Like, those are the guys.
Yeah, so, like, and I think the other thing is that everyone right now is so young.
Yeah.
That, like, there's a version of this where this is a golden generation because, like, all of these 18 and 19-year-olds end up being stars.
Right.
And, like, I mean, right now what's happening is this, like, everyone keeps developing. Like, Dest and McKinney hitting this year after Pulisic hit last year. And Adam, after Pulisic and Adams hit in a slightly different way, but, like, Adams was good and Reyna was good. Like, it's just bizarre.
Yeah, it's a...
And then Richard's getting minutes, Aronson looking like he's hitting. Like, it is an incredibly weird situation. And if everyone keeps developing on these paths, you could imagine, like, an actual golden generation where you're like, okay, even if we keep sending out talent that can get into European squads at age 20, because the development infrastructure is here, they're not going to develop this well again, like, the next time around. It's certainly possible. And so it could, but right now it's definitely not. Right now, like, it is, to me right now, mostly what we're seeing is, like, you know, improved development capacity, producing a bunch of good players, a bunch of players to dream on, and a few good players. We're not there yet.
Yeah, I mean, like, real golden generations are, like, Belgium, right? Or Spain a generation ago. Or the class of 92. in Manchester United that England was like their generations where you're like, well, you could be the best teams in the world, and like it would be wild if the US just like zipped there, but like it seems much more likely that this is just like the vanguard of sustained better talent production from the US pipelining into Europe, which like we're not talking about MLS here at all. And I think somebody, I think it was Andrew Detmer maybe asked that, like, does this change MLS's model? And I think that that's kind of complicated, right? Well, the amount of young players who could have spent a couple years in MLS and thus generated transfer fees who are now set to star for the USMNT and their top flight European clubs change the business model for MLS, or do you think they'll be fine with their players just making up the squad? And, like, I don't think MLS players being the best Americans is actually all that intrinsic to MLS's business model. Nor do I think that they, like, really want to sell great players to Europe because, like, because of the weird franchise centralized system, like, you don't make as much money by selling good players on. But, like, it is clear that the upper echelon of American talent is going to Europe. I don't think that that's bad, but I do think that, like, it's a little complicated for what MLS is and how it sells itself as a league going forward.
Yeah, and like, it would be, I mean, we've seen, like, national teams try to prevent their players from going and playing in better leagues.
Right.
Like, this is, like, the Russian national team story and the Russian Premier League story. It's a bad story. You don't want to do it. And so, like, if the U.S. happens to be developing better soccer players now, they're going to go play in the better leagues where they can play against better competition and get better and make more money. And that is, like...
I mean, like, I suppose MLS could just decide to start paying all of its players a lot more. Like, they could do that if they wanted. And then, like, maybe MLS would develop into the level of league that, like, is threatening to top European leagues. But, like, you don't even start to have that conversation until MLS decides they want to spend more money. Like, that's the bottom line.
Yeah, and like, you know, to compete with top European leagues, you're talking about spending quite a bit more money than they're spending right now.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, and, like, across the board, not, like, buying five more stars, right? Like, the current structure of, like, not paying your roster... most of your roster a lot of money for being a professional athlete and then paying a couple of stars a ton of money and then like expanding the amount of money you can pay to stars or expanding the number of stars is not how you get from here to there. You need a sustained like spending, raising the floor of what you are paying to athletes. And quite frankly, there are just a number of MLS owners for whom that defeats the whole purpose of the business model, right? Like for a number of MLS owners, the purpose of the business model is, can I own a professional sports team without having to pay the players like they're the most important thing, like I have to do in other sports. Now, the other side of this is, like, there's definitely rumors about, like, Liga MX and MLS, like, combining into a Super League. And I don't know what that does. That is, in fact, a real monkey wrench if it were to happen.
Yeah. If there were, like, actual competitive pressures driving MLS or... some of the teams that currently comprise MLS to want to actually be good. Like, there is, you can imagine, like, you know, that spending producing more of a market.
Right.
Like, yeah, this is the classic thing with sports leagues is that to a great degree, they do create their market.
It's true.
And so, you know, maybe, but for now, like, I feel like, really, really good players are going to go to Europe where they can get paid more, and
it's not an, really, like, really it's not a, that's not an existential threat to MLS is the thing.
No, MLS. I mean, MLS is like has relatively low revenues and very low costs,
yeah.
And so like it's fine,
right?
And like if they want to keep being this, I think that like this is reasonably sustainable for a period of time. It's just not going to be that great, like you know, unless you. Like it.
I mean, like, it's... Look, there's nothing wrong with being a top 20 league in the world.
Mm-hmm.
If your marketing is, we believe we are going to become a top 5 league, then you have to do the things that would take you in that direction. It isn't great to say we're going to be a top 5 league and continue to doing the things that'll keep you a top 20 league. But I do think that they've, like, tamped that down in the last few seasons. Like, there was a point in time, 5 or 6 years ago, where, like, there had been some market improvement in the quality of the league. And that was sort of what they were selling. And it's a little bit less now. Now it's become like, we want to be the spectacle. We want to pull in some big names. We're all sustainable. Like, we like have some very entertaining, good players. And, you know, we're all chill.
Yeah. All right. Well, MLS is chill. Usmant is good. Thanks for listening. We'll be back with a podcast with more of your questions, which came in to us at patreon.com/doublepivot. Thank you for the good questions. Got lots more good questions about non-Usmant topics. So that's what we're talking about.
Cheers, y'all.
Cheers.